If you were to simply Google the word paradox, and especially check out Wikipedia on it, you will be amazed at the list of paradoxes. Now, some paradoxes are very common, like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Others are more perplexing and are the problems that keep philosophers and academics up all night. Some paradoxes have been around for thousands of years, such as the ship of Theseus. Now, in this paradox, you begin to replace a ship one piece at a time. But no matter how many pieces of the ship you replace, you always consider it to be the same ship. Now, consider that you replace every single piece over time of that ship, but you still consider it to be the same ship. But now you take all the replaced parts, reassemble them, and do you now have a new ship or an old ship which already exists? Paradox. There's also what's called a value paradox that asks, why is it in our world water, which is so essential for our survival, is not as expensive as diamonds, which are considerably worth more? Paradoxes are kind of the meat and potatoes of one of my favorite characters from way back in the old Canadian Air Force show. Do you remember that thing that was on a long time ago? Ron Ferguson, very funny man, used to come out every once in a while, and do a monologue entitled The Confused Philosopher. I loved it. And boy, was he ever confused, I'll tell you. He had all kinds of weird questions. Some of Ferguson's examples were, why is it that we park in driveways and drive on parkways? When you open a new bag of cotton balls, do you have to throw the first one away? Is there anything such as military intelligence? He asked. Is it possible to have one trouser or one scissor instead of a pair? What color does a Smurf turn when it can't breathe? Why is it still called a building after it's finished? Shouldn't it be called a built? And when ancient man, this is one of my favorites, I say it every once in a while, when ancient man ate chicken for the very first time, what did he say it tasted like? And this one's for John, and I guess Janet. What do you tell a duck when you want it to lower its head? Indeed, he was a confused philosopher. But maybe he was confused because he lacked what is the most essential aspect of being a good philosopher. He lacked community. The confused philosopher always appeared alone. But all the other great philosophers in history or teachers throughout history always had a group of students or disciples that followed them and learned from them and interacted with them. They had a community. In fact, the Greek word didaskalos, which we translate as teacher, does not apply to anyone unless they also had one or more methods or disciples. In Jesus' day, and for hundreds of years even before Jesus, and long after him, there were didaskaloses or teachers. And every teacher always had pupils and disciples, correct? Now, the Greek people were really into this teacher-pupil thing. Although we have writings of several great teachers, we can surmise that there were hundreds of other Greek philosophers out there who left no writings at all, but always sought out a little group of students to follow them around. This little band of followers was always attracted to the main idea of the philosopher. The disciples chose to follow because they had an affinity with the teacher and wished to explore in greater details the ins and outs of the philosopher's ideas. The Greeks were fascinated by the world in which they lived, and over the centuries they made detailed observations of what they saw. They speculated on the meaning of what they saw. The Apostle Paul, incredible chapter. Acts 17, he goes into the great Greek city of Athens, And there we read that he would debate Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. And they thought he was a babbler, talking nonsense. They even dragged him off to the Council of Philosophers to explain the new religion he was talking about, which was Christianity, obviously. Philosophy, the debate of philosophy, was so ingrained in the Athenian society that men, it was always men, would spend all their days sitting around in the city marketplace, the agora, talking about all kinds of things. We today call it Tim Hortons, but in Greek philosophy, and indeed most schools of philosophy, whenever a new idea arose, there might also come along a new teacher and a new group of disciples to embrace and promote that idea. For example, one of the paradoxical ideas that floated around in Greek history for a long time and that philosophers debated at length was the idea that you could never step into the same river twice. It seems like a really confused idea, doesn't it? But you know what? There's serious logic behind it. They believe this for two reasons. First, the river is always flowing. It's always moving. So the river you step into, the river you stepped into before is already downstream. And second, people are always changing. So you're never the same person twice getting into the river. The Greeks also were into geometry and architecture. Who of us among us hasn't actually been in school and had to learn the Pythagorean theorem that states that the square and the hypotenuse of the right angle triangle equals the sum of the squares of the two sides. Remember that thing? Well, guess what? Pythagoras had a school of disciples. The Greeks were not alone in their thirst for knowledge because Jews too. They had teachers and they had disciples. There were those who prided themselves on being a disciple of Moses. These devoted followers of Moses believed that Moses had received from God the law and that their lives should be lived on the principles of the law. They also wanted the people to know these important precepts. So they too gathered disciples around them and taught them. There was a group in Jesus' day that, well, you may have heard of them, called Pharisees. You ever heard of them? They took the following of Moses one step even further by concerning themselves with the Talmud and the Mishnah, which were interpretations of law. And they were greatly afraid that people would unwittingly break the law. So they, to protect people from transgressing the law, they came up with 250 new laws and 350 new prescriptions or prohibitions. And they gathered a whole group of people around them and they taught their people these new commandments and people identified with being their disciples. I want to point out to you that the Greeks built a relationship with the disciples based on philosophy. The disciples of Moses based it on principle. The Pharisees based it on procedure. Into this mix, one more person appeared with a different idea and a different relationship model. It was something radically different. You see, John the Baptist had disciples too. John looked around at the way things were and he didn't like what he saw, so he started a protest movement. He was a wild man living outside of the establishment, but his disciples were attracted to him because John was against something. So John's relationship to his disciples was based on protest. As you can see, there are several ways of relating to our teacher as disciples. The only thing all these groups have in common is that there was a leader, and they all had disciples that responded to the leader's teaching. Now, into all these styles of leadership, all these models of discipleship, comes Jesus. And he does something quite different from all the rest, even John the Baptist. Jesus comes and he invites anyone and everyone to become his disciple. And the relationship, though, is not based on philosophy. It's not based on a principle. It's not based on procedure, and it's not based on any kind of protest. Jesus makes a very, very simple invitation to all of us, and it is this: come with me, or come unto me. That's all. He goes to simple, hard-working fishermen mending their nets. He goes to a tax collector counting his money, and he simply says to them, follow me. In the Gospel of Mark, as we read over the passage where Jesus was choosing his disciples, Mark makes the most beautiful observation that, quite frankly, we'll overlook if we're not careful in our reading. Mark tells us that Jesus selected his disciples so that they might be with him. Maybe you're starting to see the profound difference between other teachers and Jesus. In the Jesus movement, if I can use that phrase, disciples were invited into a relationship with a person. Not just what the person taught or believed or protested. This is the critical thing for us to understand, especially considering our gospel lesson today. You know, it's quite common today for people to talk about Christian philosophy. I hear it all the time. Because they believe there's a great deal of truth in the Christian faith. Perhaps people have looked at other philosophies and have come to the conclusion that what Jesus taught was the best. But that's as far as they go. Others may push it a bit further, saying that we need to clearly define what it means to follow Christian philosophy. And so they turn to the historic church as a source of detail for understanding the truth of what Jesus taught. And now people stand up with great vigor and great warmth and say that they are a Protestant or they are a Catholic or even a Baptist, communicating to whoever's listening their slant on the Christ teaching. Still others go further and say that we must also know what we must do and what we cannot do as Christ followers. So they're very careful about laying out before us the convictions of Christian procedure. Then there are still others who talk about following Jesus by protesting something. Maybe they're protesting poverty or war or social policies of government or something else. Their lives seem defined by what they are against in the name of Jesus. There's nothing wrong with those things or those approaches as far as they go. But there's still something wrong. There's still something missing. All of us in this room probably know someone so obsessed with one aspect of discipleship that they consider critical that they leave us cold. There is an odd thing occurs in many self-professed followers of Jesus. They talk about Jesus and then they seem to hold on inside of them unresolved anger, or they seem devoid of any kind of grace to those who don't follow their strict code of discipleship. We know people like that. What can frighten us is that there's a real danger of knowing a great deal about Jesus and thinking we know what he wants us to do, but we have no relationship with him. That's the situation that developed in the church of Corinth that Paul addresses in several chapters in 1 Corinthians, actually chapters 10 to 17. It was a young church that was arguing amongst itself, and there was absolutely no harmony there. A good part of the dissension that happened there was because the people there had misplaced loyalties to members of the community. Paul writes, some of you are saying, well, I'm a follower of Paul. Others are saying, I follow Apollos, or I follow Peter. Even some said, I follow only Jesus. Paul asks, can Christ be divided into pieces? Being a follower of Christ isn't about philosophy. It's not about procedures, principles, or even protest. Christian discipleship is unique in this world. There's nothing else like it. Because it invites us to know Jesus, not just his teaching. This is especially important to recognize in our modern world with the power of technology and mass media. You know, it's so easy to get trapped into misplaced loyalty to a popular preacher or teacher at the expense of knowing personally Jesus. We can be so captured by the attraction of a teacher's methods and message that we fail to test it by Christ's truth or by other teachers even. I love our gospel lesson today. It's a beautiful story. Philip meets Jesus, and immediately he's taken into a relationship with Jesus. He's excited to be invited to be a disciple. His first action as a disciple is to go and find Nathanael. Philip is so very excited about his encounter with Jesus, he says to Nathanael, "We found the person Moses and the prophets wrote about. His name is Jesus. He's the son of Joseph from Nazareth." What does Nathanael say at first? Nazareth? Can any good come from there? Now, pause for a moment and consider this. This is a critical moment for Nathanael. You can see the hand of God is on it, right in the midst of it. Philip could have hunkered down and began to argue the merits of following Jesus. He could have thrown all kinds of information at Nathanael. If he were alive today, Philip could have pulled out of his pocket a biblical tract or a book of apologetics to try and convince Nathanael. Instead, what does Philip do? It's beautiful. He says simply, "Just come and see for yourself. Come and meet Jesus. And see if a relationship with him is not what your soul is longing for." Maybe Nazareth was a backwater kind of place, but Philip thought he found something of great value. Actually, someone of great value. He found the pearl of great price. He found the treasure that was hidden in a field, which was worth everything he owned. To borrow a metaphor from the parables. You know, I ran across a very interesting story. It was in the Associated Press back in April 10th, 2004. In a slum district of Manila, in a place that's awfully crowded and not a very nice place to live, there was a gold rush that made the situation even worse there. It all started when a 15-year-old boy named Alfredo Gallo was combing the riverbed looking to see if he could find anything of value, and he found a big chunk of gold in the refuse in the river. He took it home, and his father immediately sold a nugget for $500, probably worth a lot more than that. And he bought a television and a bicycle. But once word got out about that gold nugget being found in the river, hundreds of people flocked down to that filthy river looking for precious metal. Though the river is filthy and strewn with garbage, many people saw it with new eyes. One village chief commented, "It's a real puzzle. All we got from this before was trash." Nathanael could not believe anything good could ever come from Nazareth. But he soon discovered that the very best treasure of all came from that little village. And that treasure was not a philosophy to apply to life. It was not a principle to follow. It was not a procedure to make one happier or more acceptable to God. It was not a protest to commit one's energy to. That precious treasure, more valuable than all you possess, is Jesus. I wonder, Have you found that treasure for yourself?